This is Digital Story Podcast number 523, March 15th, 2016. Today's theme is, Are You Really Seeing Light? I'm Derek Story. When you're standing in the snow and the sun breaks through the clouds, what do you think about? For me, it usually goes something like this. First, where are my sunglasses? Followed by, this is at least plus 1.5 EV. Seriously, evaluating light is an ongoing dialogue in my head. It's the only way I could really improve my skills with exposure. In today's show, I'm going to talk about seeing light and using that skill to improve our photographs. Are you really seeing light? So this is the way my internal dialogue goes. There are three major things that I'm thinking about when I'm taking pictures as it relates to light. And I'm going to cover those three things in today's top story. So first I'll tell you what they are, and then, you know, I'll go into more detail. So the first one is, you know, do I have enough ISO? And, you know, this really relates to how much light there is, okay? And then the second one is, how much latitude do I have? And what I mean by that, with my capture device. And I'm going to cover those things. And then I'm going to talk about tapping exposure compensation, which I think is one of the most important settings on your camera. So I'm going to get into all three of those things today, and we're going to have a good discussion. Of course, it'll be only me talking about light, because I mean, photography is light, and we always have to circle back around to this every now and then. All right, so let's start with the first one. Do I have enough ISO? Now, when I'm outside and it's a bright, sunny day, this is not really an issue. And in fact, anymore, what I do is I just put it on auto ISO when I'm outside, just shooting in sun. Unless I have a specific reason not to, I put it on auto ISO. And the reason why I do that is because it is a bit of a safety net in that if I suddenly walk into a shadow area and I see something and I just start shooting, then an adjustment can be made by the camera, a fairly easy adjustment. Instead of me, you know, shooting at ISO 100 when it really should be 400 or ISO 320. So, you know, it's a bit of a safety net, and I like that. Now, when the light does get lower, though, if I'm shooting, let's say, at twilight or inside or something like that, then I'm really thinking about ISO. I mean, I want to take control then. Auto ISO is... The reason why I want to take it off auto ISO then is that I really want to be a part of the whole calculation on what's happening. And I want to increase the ISO setting enough so that I can get the shot that I need, a quality shot without camera shake. But yet I don't want it to go up so high. I don't automatically want it to go up to 3200 or something like that if I don't need to. If I can get away with 1600, I'll do that. If I can get away with ISO 800, I'll do that. So, you know, that's kind of what my thinking is there. Now, when I'm shooting film, you know, that's more locked in. I mean, that's the thing about film. And that's the reason why I usually work with ISO 400 film, so that I have a little bit more latitude. I like having that speed. And so I'll put 400 in, and then that's kind of my everyday film there. But the equation is still going on in my head, because since I can't raise the ISO of the film that's in the camera, what I might do, though, is go to a really fast lens. Go to my f1.7 prime lens, even though otherwise it might not be the perfect lens, but it will let enough light in to where I can do the shot that I want. So I'll make the adjustments that way. So my conversation in my head around light usually starts with ISO, just to make sure that that setting is where I want. Now, here's the thing about ISO. When you take it off auto and you put it on something else, let's say you put it on 1600, you really have to practice at putting it back to auto once you're done with that shot. I mean, once you know that you're not going to be shooting in that setting anymore, you need to put it back. Because otherwise, oh, heaven forbid, what if you know, there's a beautiful sunrise the next morning and there's a really bright area of the sky and it's fantastic and you shoot at 1600. You don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. And especially if you're in program mode, you know, and it puts it up to F22 or something. I don't know. So anyway, just try to remember when you take it off auto ISO to return it to auto ISO once you're done with the shot. Okay, let's move on here. Next thing, how much latitude do I have? So RAW files are more forgiving than JPEGs. Negative film is more forgiving than slide. And I am thinking about that when I'm shooting because, especially if I'm shooting something that has a lot of dynamic range, there are some real bright areas, there are some real dark areas. And I'm thinking, well, what should I do with this? You know, should I go in the middle? And do I have enough latitude to cover those highlights and to cover those shadow areas? Or do I hedge my bets and go more for the highlights and then try to recover the shadows? If I'm shooting RAW, that's a pretty good option because chances are I will be able to recover some of that detail. If I'm shooting JPEG, then, you know, recovering highlight detail and shadow detail, not as good. Really isn't. I mean, that's the one area where I really notice the difference between RAWs and JPEGs is recovering highlight and shadows. So if I'm in JPEG mode, then I'm either thinking I got to switch to RAW or RAW plus JPEG so I can get that latitude that I want, or I have to do something else. You know, I have to add light or do something. Okay. But you really need to have that as part of your conversation, because you do have more latitude with RAW files than JPEGs. And if you need that latitude, make sure that you're shooting RAW and so that you can get what you need. And then try to find an exposure that's maybe not right in the middle, maybe edging a little bit more toward the highlights so that you can recover as much in post-production as possible. This is a conversation you need to have in your head. Now, when you're shooting film, you have much more latitude with negative film, print film, than you do with slide film, which is why I hardly shoot slides anymore. I mean, really, I mean, the whole slide thing for me, I've really fallen in love over the years with black and white print film and with color neg film. And I really like those. I mean, there was a long time when all I shot was slides because they are so beautiful on the light box. They really are. But in terms of just having something to work with, and, you know, I get those negatives scanned, and then I try to pull as much information out of them as possible. I just like the latitude that negatives give me more than slide film. So that's why in the analog side of my life, it's mostly negative film, because I like that latitude. Now we get to exposure compensation itself. And I'll tell you, this was a weird thing for me in my very early days of photography. I really had a hard time getting my head around how to adjust the camera for really bright scenes and really dark scenes. And the whole thing, you know, where the, you know, aperture number gets bigger, but the hole gets smaller and, you know, all that kind of stuff, it befuddled me. It did. It befuddled me. I hate to admit it, but it did. So I practiced and, you know, I got over that. I almost felt like I had dyslexia for light or dyslexia for camera settings or something. I don't know. I just felt like that it shouldn't have been that hard, but it was. And, you know, that's in my past now. And maybe that's why I do this internal dialogue. So because I could compensate for, you know, whatever that shortcoming was that I had. At any rate, I did get it straight in my head. And so here's a review. And you guys know this, but let's just refresh for a second so we're all on the same page. So what the camera wants to do is capture at neutral gray. okay? The color of a blue sky, color of a grassy field, those are all tones that the light meter is calibrated for. It likes 18% gray, okay? So if you shoot something that's outside of that middle zone there, if you shoot something really bright, like I was talking about earlier, the snow scene, what the meter is going to read and what the camera is going to try to do, even the most sophisticated camera we have going now, is going to try to pull that really bright scene back to the middle. So it's going to dull your bright scene. By the same token, if you shoot something that's really dark and rich and black, it's going to take that black scene and try to push it up to the middle and make it more gray, because that's what it wants to do. And you have to override it. So in order to override it, what you have to do is be able to see it in the first place. Now, you know, one of the things that I do all the time is that I'm always shooting in my little, what I call my little eBay studio, which is, you know, basically a white box with a white sweep and light coming from all sorts of angles. And you put products on it and I shoot them. And that way, since the product's on white, it floats in space and it's great for web and everything else. So that is definitely a meter challenge for the camera, right? Because if I put a black camera on this, you know, in this white box with this white sweep background, and don't do anything other than press the shutter button, that camera is gonna be underexposed, right? Because all that white is gonna throw off the meter. And I'm talking about my latest state-of-the-art digital wonders will not get that exposure right. They just don't do it. So what I have to do for my little eBay setup is I do exposure compensation, and I usually start at right about plus one. Sometimes I'll even go a little bit higher. Sometimes I'll go, 1.3 or even, 1.6 or 7, something like that. It just depends on how small the item is and how much white there is and all that stuff. But it's always a plus setting. So that's what you have to do with exposure compensation. If you want to bring back the brightness, You go to plus. Now, if I was shooting in a black box with a black sweep and all that, and I didn't want it yucky gray, then I would have to decrease the exposure. And that's exposure compensation in the negative side. So that would be, -1.0 or -1.3 or whatever it happens to be. Now, generally speaking these days, because I do have latitude, both on the digital side and the film side, I usually start at plus 1.0 or minus 1.0. I don't fool around with plus 0.3, plus 0.6, or 0.7, whatever. And I just start at one. And then, with a digital camera, all I have to do is look at the shot on the LCD. And isn't that nice? Isn't that nice to be able to do that? Just check your work. Now, when you do that, make sure you check the histogram. And the way that you do that is you just press the info button a few times until you get the view with the histogram showing. And look at it, you want to make sure that you haven't overexposed too much, where you're just losing all sorts of detail on the white side. But I'll tell you, if you're shooting like in an eBay box, then, you should be all the way over on the right side there. And of course, you'll learn with practice. But the thing that I've really learned is that, LCDs lie. And they lie about sharpness, and they sometimes lie about exposure too. Histograms don't lie. So, take a look at your histogram, make sure you're on the beam, and then you're in good shape. Now, if you're shooting film, you just have to know, right? You just have to know your film, and you have to know your camera, and that takes practice. So, but the same rules apply. And on film, I'm usually a bit more conservative. I'm usually just going, plus one or minus one, and then hoping that the latitude of the film, since I'm shooting print film, can carry that for me. Those are the three things that I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about, first of all, what is my ISO and is it appropriate for the lighting scene? then I'm thinking about how much latitude do I have with my capture device? And that applies to both digital and analog. And then once I parse through those, then I'm thinking, do I need to use exposure compensation? Now, a really fun exercise to do to practice this is just look at the scene that you want to take, especially if it's something that's on a little bit of an extreme, bright or dark. Do all the settings, set your ISO, you know, make sure that you have the right file type, set your exposure compensation, and take one shot. Just take one shot of it, and then review your shot. How close did you come? How close did you come? You know, and just practice that. Now, you know, all of my film cameras have auto bracketing, right? Where they go minus one, plus one, you know, zero, or one and a half, zero. I never use it. I never use it. You know why I don't use it? Because I'm cheap. Because I am. I got 36 exposures. I'm not going to use three exposures for every shot just because I can't figure out the darn exposure. No, I am. Now, what I do is if I'm questioning a scene, I will do this. Okay, I'm fessing up here. I'll shoot it at what the meter reads, and then I'll take my best guess for plus or minus on the exposure compensation and shoot a second frame with exposure compensation. And then I turn it back to zero and I go on to the next thing. So, but, you know, because the thing about auto bracketing, you know, one of those three shots is going to be way off. You know, it's going to be way off. So at least this way, if I'm in question, then I'm only burning two frames and not three, which gives me so many more shots, right? 36 is not very much. Okay, so anyway, do the test, practice a little bit, really practice looking at, you know, these lighting situations. Take your best guess and then compare it to the results on the computer or on the back of the camera. Adjust accordingly. Really sharpen your skills on this, I'll tell you. This really makes you feel like a craftsman when you're nailing exposures left and right. In the news. This is a disturbing story, and I know there's some hyperbole here, so I'll read this story and then I'll talk a little bit about it. This is from Petapixel. Apple, FBI could force us to turn on iPhone cameras for spying. And this is what Petapixel wrote. Apple has been in a highly publicized legal battle with the FBI, which is demanding that Apple help bypass the security features of the iPhone 5C that was owned by the gunman in the 2015 San Bernardino attack. Apple has refused, saying that complying would set a dangerous precedent that could open up backdoors to its popular smartphones. In addition to permanently reducing the security of phones, it would only be a matter of time before the government forces Apple to turn on iPhone cameras and microphones to spy on people, Apple says. Quote, this is Eddie Q is quoted here. Someday they will want Apple to turn on a user's camera or microphone, says Apple head of services Eddie Q in an interview with Univision. We can't do that now. But what if we were forced to do that? Where would this stop? In a divorce case? In an immigration case? In a tax case? Someday, someone will be able to turn on an iPhone's microphone. That should not happen in this country. All right, so that's the story. I think Eddie Q's a little frustrated, as a lot of folks over at Apple, about the San Bernardino case. And I don't know where you stand on it. The point of this story isn't so much the San Bernardino case, although it definitely is related, but just the idea, just the fact that this could happen, that our own phones could be used to spy on us, is not far-fetched. It really isn't, in terms of technology capability, right? I mean, it can happen now. I mean, you know, the ability to do this is there now. So then it's really just a matter of, you know, in what case can it be turned on? And I just think that's super disturbing because, you know, we're carrying these devices. We've heard the same thing about smart TVs, right? Samsung smart TVs that, you know, where they can actually capture what's going on in the room. If it really gets to that point, if that's ever happening or it comes out that that's been happening, that is going to change a lot of stuff. That is going to change a lot of stuff. And it will with me for sure. Because, you know, I already know that I can be tracked by carrying around my smartphone. I've come to terms with that. But the fact that the camera or the microphone could be turned on and listen in, that, I don't know. I don't have the stomach for that. So I think that's a disturbing story. I'm not saying that it will happen. But just the fact that it could happen really bothers me a lot. Capture One Pro Essential Training. Oh, yay! Okay, so this is a journey that began more than a year ago. And now I'm happy to announce that Capture One Pro Essential Training is now available on lynda.com. LYNDA.com. This is a really good training. I worked really hard on it. And you know, I think that I really was the right guy to do this essential training for Lynda because I already had a good knowledge of photo management software, having worked with Aperture, Lightroom, and iPhoto, plus all these other apps over the years. So I really do understand how the photo management software works. So I'm kind of coming from a good foundation. But Capture One Pro, I had to learn from the ground up. I had to learn it from the ground up. And I did start learning it last year. I, you know, was doing the webinars with Capture One. I was doing all that. And then I didn't want to get to the point where I had mastered it before I started doing the essential training. And the reason being is that I didn't want to assume anything. When I did the training, I wanted to have how I learned this fresh in my mind so I could share that with you if you're watching it. And what I tried to do with the training was not show you every feature that was in Capture One Pro. My goal was to show you a best practices for using Capture One Pro. In other words, I spent all this time, I spent months and months working with this application, learning it, taking notes, and then distilling all that down into the things that I thought were the best approaches for using the software. Now, I think what happens is when you approach this training, or at least what I hope happens when you approach this training, is that you look at this interface and what at first seems a bit overwhelming with all the little tabs and everything. And then after watching a few movies and practicing just a little bit, suddenly it seems much easier. Suddenly it just seems like, wow, that's not bad at all. I can do this. I can do this. I can. And in fact, I really like it. And that's why I wanted to take the best practices approach, because I didn't want to overwhelm you with 12 different ways to do the same thing. I wanted to show you the best way to do something, at least as I see it. Now, as I update the training in upcoming years and months, new features and me trying different things, I may make some adjustments there. But I think what I am showing you right now really is the easiest way to master this program. And that's why I'm so excited about it. So you can download a 30-day free trial of Capture One Pro. And then you can, if you're trying to move an Aperture library or a Lightroom library over to test it, I have an ebook on Rocky Nook on how to do that. You can download that for free. And then you can either do the one-month Lynda thing, or you can just try the free movies even. There's a whole bunch of free movies in this training. And see what you think. Now, this is only if you want to do something. If you are just thrilled with Lightroom and happy with it, then this isn't for you, right? This is only for those folks that are a little lost right now, or maybe don't have quite the right fit for their photo management application. And the way that I'm approaching photo management right now is I'm really focusing on three areas. So Capture One Pro at the high end. That is for serious enthusiasts and pros. Photos for OS X at the consumer leading up to the enthusiast level. And I just finished the book on that for Rocky Nook. And of course I have the Linda training on it. And I think Photos for OS X is far better than people give it credit for. So if you look at Capture One and you go, I either don't want to spend the money for the software or it's more than I need, then I would go to Photos for OS X and take a look at that. And I think both are good. They're just, you know, for different types of photographers. And I really like both applications. And then the third thing is Flickr. Flickr has quietly been improving over the last couple years. And I'm working on a training for Flickr right now for Linda. And, you know, with the introduction of the camera roll and then adding all the features tied to the camera roll, suddenly, and then having the 1 terabyte of storage, suddenly Flickr is a really cool application that fits right in between the other two. I think it complements either one of them. And I think it especially complements Capture One Pro because Capture One Pro doesn't have that online component like Photos does. So those are the three. Now, someone wrote me on Facebook and they asked, you know, a very reasonable question. It seems like I have gone out of my way to talk about everything but Lightroom. And it's not because I don't like Lightroom, honest to God. And if you're a Lightroom user, you have to trust me on this. It's because there are already 5,000 people teaching Lightroom. So I don't need to jump into that pool, especially if I'm not passionate about it. You know, just like some people prefer Canon, some people prefer Nikon, some people prefer Mac, some people Windows, Android, iOS. It goes on and on and on. And we just say, hey, that's great that you prefer that and that and that, right? We don't think about it. And it's the same thing with photo management software. You know, if you prefer Lightroom over Capture One Pro, if you prefer Photos, you know, over Lightroom, that's great. As long as you find the right application for you. So I don't talk about Lightroom not as much because I don't like it. It's just that I really do like these other two and they're a better fit for me. All right. So anyway, Capture One Pro, it's on lynda.com. I'm publishing stuff on the Digital Story. Under the photography pop-up menu on the Digital Story, I've added a Capture One Pro category. So I've pulled together all the stuff I'm writing about there so you can go and brush up. There's also one there for Photos for OS X. Alrighty. So I'm really excited about this. I'm loving the experience. And if you happen to fall into the camp where you might be interested in it too, go check it out. Member quotes of the week. Intelligent comments culled from the Digital Story Facebook page. So in regards to last week's Facebook post, Canon T6 announcement, I had one comment that I really want to highlight here. So Phil wrote, I can't afford a 1DX Mark II, but if I had ordered one, I think I'd be a little miffed at the new entry level offering features that I wouldn't get with the flagship model costing in the region of 10 times more. It's nice to see Wi-Fi and NFS on the new Canon, but commiserations to the 1DX Mark II buyers. And I want to comment on that because I totally get what Phil is saying. And Canon has a history of doing this. They tend to bring in new features with their consumer level camera. And then the pro level camera has, you know, these outrageous specs in terms of auto focusing points and, you know, things like that. But it, a lot of times won't have a lot of these cool features. Even up until recently, Wi-Fi, right? And that is just the way they do it. And I guess the thinking is that, you know, pros need pro stuff, but consumers need to be lured with all the connectivity. And it has a mode for food photography. I mean, that should tell you a bit about it right there. It has a mode for food photography. So Phil, I totally get what you're saying. And I'll tell you, it is something that Canon has always done, and I'm pretty sure will continue to do. Okay, just a few updates and such. Do you follow the Digital Story Member Photo of the Day on Facebook? It's for inspiration. And you can participate on the TDS Member Photo of the Day by, you know, joining our Flickr group. You know, we have the Digital Story Flickr group. All the images that are posted to that group are potential candidates for being featured on the Digital Story Member Photo of the Day on our Facebook page. So I just wanted to throw that out there. It feels good to be selected as the Member Photo of the Day. And then it's also fun to see what other people in our community are doing. The Point Reyes Photography Workshop, we still have one room open. We had it closed and then it opened back up. So that last room, I tell you, it's still there though. Maybe it's your room. Maybe that's why it's still there. The workshop is August 19th through 21st, 2016. If you're interested, just use the send me info form on our workshops page, or just write me Derek@thedigitalstory.com and I'll get you hooked up with all the information. And finally, a big thanks to the folks at Red River Paper. I'm working with them right now on the Out of Chicago conference that's coming up in June. And, you know, of course, they're sponsoring me to go there and speak. And I just have to tell you that working with them is such a joy. And I'm working on some new stuff with some of their paper to go from film to scan to their fiber-based paper to make these wonderful prints. This is the kind of stuff that you can do with their quality product. They have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. Thank you so much for hanging out with me and working on some stuff for next week. Come back and join me. Until then, have a great week. Do a little, you know, testing with your exposures, and then we'll circle back and work on something new next week. Until then, bye-bye now.